Hello, and welcome to Exiting the Cave, a podcast dedicated to sharing philosophical insights, the practice of epistemic humility, and generally learning how to look directly into the sun. My name is Greg Gauthier, and I'm an amateur philosophy geek. I'll be your host on this journey. I hope you enjoy it. In this episode of the Exiting the Cave podcast, I'll be interviewing author John Holroyd. He's the author of the book Judging Religion, A Dialogue for Our Time, and it's just been released this year by Silverwood Books. Before heading into the interview, I think I'd like to offer an introduction into who John Holroyd is. Originally from North Yorkshire, he studied philosophy, theology, and religious studies at King's College London in the 1980s. He has since taught religious studies and philosophy in both state and independent schools as head of religious studies at St. Dunstan's College in South London for over 20 years. He currently lectures at the London School of Philosophy and teaches philosophy for the Workers' Educational Association. He has published articles in Philosophy Now magazine and The Ethical Review. The interview begins with John providing us with a little bit of background on himself and on his motivations for the writing of the book. And with that, I give you John Holroyd.
I mean, the motivation has gathered pace over a long period of time, I suppose. I was brought up in a very religious home, so we said prayers in the morning before I went to school, grace before meals, no football on Sundays, I went to church twice on Sunday. It was a Methodist, quite conservative Methodist home. My dad was particularly strong influence in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's quite natural coming from that background that I took the whole thing very seriously. I didn't find church boring at all. I was very interested in what the various local preachers in the Methodist circuit that I was in had to say. I was interested in interpreting the Bible. I was interested in the vision that this kind of Christianity had for my life and for the world. So when I went to sixth form and started doing religious studies at A-level, mm-hmm. and got into two things really, the beginnings of biblical criticism and philosophy of religion, and I thoroughly enjoyed them both. It was not simply a study, it was about the meaning and the direction, really, of my life.
Mm.
So, I came under the influence of someone to whom the book is dedicated, someone called John Moss Smith. It's dedicated to two people, my wife Helen and John Moss Smith. John is actually still alive. He's now in his mid-90s. But he is a progressive Christian.
Hmm.
And he certainly took me in a direction that began to raise very serious questions about various things that I'd come to believe. But rather than bridling at this, I found the whole study compelling because it was about evidence, it was about argument. And I felt myself embarking on a glorious adventure, which in some ways I would say is ongoing now. So that's the beginning of the motivation. I mean, at university, I found intellectually that was just some of the most exciting years of my life. And I came out of Christianity probably round about early on in my second year, and for reasons to do partly with biblical criticism, but much more to do with problems of evil and suffering.
Mm.
And I focus on that in chapter 9 of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when in 2006, you know, decades later, I had been teaching religious studies for, by then, the best part of 20 years in schools. I had not simply been teaching about Christianity and philosophy of religion and ethics, but I'd also been teaching quite consistently, year in, year out, about Islam, particularly at GCSE. And I'd also become part of a multicultural world that I passionately believed in. You know, the children that were in front of me were Hindu, were various sorts of Christian. I've taught Jehovah's Witness children, Nichiren Daishonin Buddhist children, children of all kinds of backgrounds. And so when I came across the God delusion at the end of 2006, beginning of 2007, I was concerned that this put together whole religions, packaged them up, and really missold them, it seemed to me, as being almost certainly in error, if not certainly in error, as being morally adrift,
mm.
Totally morally adrift, as a whole morally adrift. And that there was a fundamental conflict between religious beliefs and reason, religious beliefs and science. And while I'm sympathetic to some of what Dawkins is saying, I'm particularly sympathetic to the idea that we shouldn't be in any way deferential towards religion. This wholesale packaging of specific religions, and most especially of religion as a whole, as being particularly morally problematic, really without exception, including liberal forms of religion. Well, I was left asking then, where was the evidence for this in such a total way? And it was the beginning of, you know, making me look back across my life, look back across my teaching career, and beginning to think, maybe I could and should write something about this.
Mm.
And so by the time we move on to 2013, 2014, which is when I really started to think about the book and put pen to paper, it's been some time in gestation, you know, I was coming to the view that rather than writing, for example, about science and religion, which is an enormous topic that people have written at great length about, or writing extensively about the philosophy of religion, that instead I would put a focus on the moral character of religion as it's practiced today, rather than doing any grand historical study as well. And as I thought things through and moving through to 2015, and at the end of 2015, I left school teaching entirely to focus on the book. I had decided that the main focus was going to be Islam and Christianity,
hmm.
As they are practiced now, and an understanding and an evaluation of the moral character of those faiths. That was, and the beginning of the dialogue about that, I was going to pick up various threads that come from writers like Richard Dawkins, or in the case of Islam, particularly Sam Harris in his book, The End of Faith.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit about what motivated me. I think the only other thing to say is that I think the moral character of religion really matters, and it matters practically in our lives. You know, where we choose to send our children to school, whether or not we, you know, go to midnight mass because some people in the street do, some of our friends do, or is this something that we're just not going to give religion that kind of deference? Whether we really campaign for example, the disestablishment of the Church of England. You know, there are real issues that are political, that are local, and that are personal, that this question about the moral character of religion impinges upon. And that's before we come on to very important questions about multiculturalism.
Yeah.
And the kinds of multiculturalism that are can be, I believe, beneficial, and other forms that I think are less beneficial.
Yeah, it's the book was especially interesting to me in exactly the fact that it wasn't an abstract treatise. There was a lot of contact between the notion of religion as a system of thought and a system of beliefs and how it plays out in the real world. The chapter on schooling, for example, comes to mind, and also the chapter on the case study on Islam was interesting in that way. Yes. As well.
Well, I could say something about that just briefly. I'm very critical of the view that religion is fundamentally, and whether we're talking about Christianity or Islam, but particularly the case, I would say, with Islam, whether or not it is essentially a system of thought, a system of ideology that then plays out in practice. A phrase that is often used is the idea of orthopraxis.
Mm.
And it puts the emphasis really on the practice of religion and how the practice and the habit of religion within the lives of individuals and communities and civilizations is as much an engine that drives belief, drives ideology, drives conviction, as it is the other way around. I think there is a misunderstanding based on a stereotype about the creeds in Christianity, and that, well, everything must flow from a set of beliefs. And it seems to me when we examine the dynamics of how religions actually play out in people's lives, we take examples of this, that is not particularly to be found. If I give one example that I mention in the book, radicalization has clearly taken place and grown within specific elements of Islam in recent decades. One scholar who I refer to, Shiraz Meir, takes a number of phrases, among them the very familiar word jihad.
Mm-hmm.
And he plots really how through a number of theatres of war, this word has become radicalized. It's an extraordinary piece of ideological archaeology that Meir has accomplished, because he charts really how war has been the engine, the driver really, in this case and in certain respects of language and of concepts.
Mm.
And it keys in too with the whole notion of intellectual history that a number of Cambridge scholars have been engaged with. That is, one to say, events, the material world, what is happening on the ground actually is really the engine that gives rise to ideas and ideology and so forth. And I think that that's very important. I think the only other thing to add there is that I would also say that in very secular cultures such as Britain, this is particularly the case where religion is in many respects on the back foot. It, through cultural osmosis, imbibes things like environmentalism, to take an example. It imbibes forms of egalitarianism such as LGBT rights that not very long ago it in various forms, Christian, Islamic, would not have been inclined to take on.
That's true.
And I would refer particularly to aspects of Christianity there. We have, in Moorish Spain, we have a lot of, homosexual poetry and so forth. But Christianity has been has not been open to homosexuality as a way of life. I mean, Islam doesn't have a good track record, don't misunderstand me, at all. It does not. But there is not a universal pattern there within Islam.
That's interesting. Would you say then that culture ultimately is what over time characterizes a religion? If culture is the driver, it would make sense that religion would be a sort of expression in one facet of that culture then.
I think there is a problem speaking in these block terms of culture, religion, and so forth. I was teaching a course a while ago on philosophy of culture, and I began by looking at the history of the word culture and how it has interwoven with concepts such as civilization in the way that I take you to be using it as being a kind of an encapsulation of art, of literature, of all the various expressions of a people and a way of life.
Social attitudes.
Yeah, social attitudes and so forth. I don't see religion as being something that is independent of this. I think we always need to start from the ground up. We need to start from particular situations rather than coming along with big theories about block concepts. The more we move up towards generalizations, the more we're building a tower of improbability. We absolutely have to be looking at an empirical approach is to look at instances of what is happening, to raise questions about what is happening, whether we're talking about a history of Christian anti-Semitism, whether we're talking about, as I do in chapter three, about, for example, liberation theology and the interaction between that and evangelical fundamentalist Christianity in Latin America. Each occasion, we need to be looking for the detail.
Those two examples actually were really fascinating because it was an interesting juxtaposition of religion being heavily influenced by the culture on the one hand, but then on the other hand, a religion that was sort of disrupting a culture. The liberation theology seemed to be sort of imbibing the culture and sort of mirroring back a kind of desire of the people, while evangelicals who went there to proselytize were kind of, that seemed to be more of an imposition on the local sort of civilization or culture, or not quite sure how to describe it.
Yes, I mean that's an interesting example to raise to do with this issue of religion and culture. And of course, we do have impositions. You know, we just need to think about the invasions of South America by the Portuguese and so forth. And now, yes, I see liberation theology as something that has been part and parcel of aspects of Latin American culture. But we do, you know, it's also part and parcel of something far more than Latin American. From a religious point of view, some religious points of view, it is part of God's will. It's metacultural. Now, that's not my personal view, but I do bridle against this idea that religion is a sort of subset of culture.
Mm.
It's a view, for example, that I don't think takes sufficient account of the views of religious people, and that the subheading of the book, a subtitle, A Dialogue for Our Time, we have to bring in religious people as being always, you know, a group to whom we return in checking out, not because they are the touchstone, but because there are a series of checks in terms of the direction of our understanding and evaluation. And I think that a problem with this religion culture issue, where in effect we're saying, well, religion is a subset of culture more generally, is that is generally not how religious people feel. I think it's quite a secular mindset as well. Now, all that is notwithstanding that evangelical fundamentalist forms of American Christianity find their way into South America. They are directed there for various political reasons by the US government. They are funded by the US government in the 70s, 80s, so forth.
Some African countries too, yeah?
Yes. As part of a counter against, you know, amalgams of religion, of Christianity and Marxism. But for example, one thing that I do write about in the book is that some forms of such evangelical Christianity, as it changes and changes and changes, is that parts of it have become distinctly left-wing.
Mm.
Not the intention, obviously, but that's something that has clearly come about in particularly in São Paulo, in the favelas of São Paulo, for example. Again, this business of religion and culture, yes, we do have impositions there, but that they are also bringing, you know, culture with them. So I'm wanting to resist the taxonomy, really, of culture and religion that is being suggested in some ways.
In another part of the book, actually, I think it was during the analysis of Islam, you mentioned that one Islamic scholar just rejected the whole idea of separating Islam into a political system, a cultural system, a religion, that they were all somehow one thing. The sort of rejection of the distinctions as well.
Yes. I mean, these categories, they're obviously linguistic categories. They're also, cultural categories in various ways in themselves. And this is part of the heavy lifting, really, of the study of religion.
Mm.
Trying to, you know, get the lens through which we're doing the study as clear as possible. And that lens is, among many other things, a linguistic lens and a cultural lens. And it also has to take on board a huge amount of humility, in the sense that, you know, as I clearly state, the idea that we can stand outside of a religion and have an objective view of it and fully understand it is mistaken. And so this is why our milestones and our guiding lights are people, groups, often with conflicting views. Some will be those outsiders, sociologists of religion, historians. Others will be ex-members of religion, the victims of religion. Others will be a wide variety of religious believers. And that they will be, as it were, and they are in the book, our guiding light in terms of our conversation about a combination of understanding and judgment that always need to, you know, remain together. So I think we need to take seriously when Muslim scholars say we can't, you know, make these separations. They are artificial. Islam is a way of life. In Christianity too.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you that.
The idea that we can, as it were, privatize religion is again a fundamentally secular idea. It makes sense, perhaps, to some spokespeople for the National Secular Society or some people who go on the offensive against religion to push it firmly into the private sphere where it has no political impact. Religion moves against that, both whether it's Christian, whether it's Buddhist. Even let's take an example of a religion that would seem to, you know, be very, very happy with the private sphere. If we look at Jehovah's Witnesses, who refuse to vote, they refuse conscription.
Mm-hmm.
They were sent to concentration camps by the Nazis because of these things. They don't want to have anything to do with politics at all, regarding it as really utterly corrupt, irretrievably corrupt. And the thing to hope for is the second coming, when this way of working, this corrupt world, will be swept aside, really. Now, even there, that what sociologists call a world-denying form of faith, it still, by its very world-denying nature, it is still making a political statement, a very compelling political statement to some people, that many people are very persuaded of the idea that all politics is terribly corrupt, and that even that they want to say, and it couldn't be otherwise, and some people would find that persuasive. So I think even, you know, taking something as unusual and world-denying as Jehovah's Witnesses, still, you know, they are, in a rather odd way, they are making political statements,
mm-hmm.
That, you know, that are important.
Do you think that the impulse to categorize and to compartmentalize is a product of our media culture, or is it a broader sort of part of, for lack of a better way to put it, human nature to want to define and segment?
Yes. Well, to come to the first question, I think that the media is a product of a desire to categorize. They are time poor in terms of what they're trying to achieve. Categorizing is an essential shorthand in terms of what they're doing. The soundbite is something that has traction. And the great difficulties with this is that while things are communicated, they're so often really a smokescreen of half-truths. And you know, to be fair to the media, in some ways, how could it possibly be otherwise, given their time constraints and the constraints in terms of understanding that that they need to engage with if they're going to understand what they need to understand to report well on the wide variety of things that they report about. So, but I do think that this taxonomical approach, generalizations, totalizing, I think it is fundamentally a psychological disposition that is driven by a desire to conquer in terms of, we might say, well, that is what understanding is. Understanding is conquering the map of what is to be known. And yeah, that's it is a mastery. You know, that's an interesting word, to have a kind of dominance of knowledge, to be able to manipulate and get a full grasp of a subject or an issue.
To give something a word is to control it in a way.
Yes, and I think that we need to persistently think about how this power drive actually impairs our ability to understand. You know, that it gets in the way in itself of exactly what we're trying to do.
So one of the things that really concerns me about the media as regards its coverage of, well, just about anything, but mainly religion as a point of contact with this book, is the fact that not only does it suffer from the problem of oversimplification as a result of categorization and things like that we were just talking about, yes, but also the desire to, as we say now, attract eyeballs. And that's to, with something like religion, and even with politics, that to me seems extremely dangerous. When the currency is heightened emotion, there can't really be any understanding there, can there?
And that's an interesting point. The last point that you make, when you say it, with heightened emotion, there can't really be any understanding. Put like that, I wouldn't necessarily agree. I mean, many would say that it depends on what we're trying to understand. Religious experience is obviously in various forms, highly, intensely, at times ecstatically, emotional reality. And exactly the engine from which understanding is driven for many religious people. But I completely get what you're saying. When, as it were, all sorts of particularly negative emotions are driven by headlines and by hate speech, that then things don't simply go wrong. That they are very much inclined to be very misunderstood too. And I think the half-truth is a particularly important idea to put across. Because there is, in my view, some militancy present within Islam, that is not a reason to think that it is, in Harris's view, written into its DNA, that it is a majority perspective, or even a significant minority perspective. It isn't. And yet, the trade in half-truths is something that does do great harm, and the way that the media trades in half-truths is designed to incite emotional responses. That's how papers and other news outlets sell, by trading on people's emotional reactions, which is why controversy is something that is a focus. Religion doesn't do uniquely badly from this. Although I think in Britain and in Northwest Europe, that is quite heavily secular, it does come off fairly badly. And where it's part of a body politic too, that at times, in the case of Islam, is in the UK racist, I think then we encounter some real problems. And this is just hearsay, so I could be wrong about this, but when Boris Johnson compared Muslim women wearing the veil, wearing the niqab, with pillar boxes, I understand that in the few days following that remark and its publicity, that there was a sharp rise in attacks on Muslim women. So I think that the media, parts of the media, need to actually be significantly more responsible. And I don't think they're particularly inclined to be. If so, the watchdog of the media has repeatedly sanctioned various news outlets for their Islamophobia. And the UN has even got involved in reprimanding elements of the British press for its involvement in inciting hatred on some occasions. So I think, yeah, that there are significant problems in the coverage of religion. And I do go into detail in that in chapter two.
Yeah.
There's a lot more there that I haven't even referred to that is very important in that chapter.
Well, one of the most vexing half-truths, as you put it, that I see is the constant trafficking in attitude surveys. So I see a lot of these attitude surveys about whether Muslims in Britain think that gays should be executed, or that jihad is a good idea, jihad in the militaristic sense, or that, you know, all the things that you would expect, this sort of everyday, you know, go to work sort of person would be shocked by. To me, that seems to be, I don't want to say intentionally, but there's a kind of desire for a ready state of fear in the population. And these kinds of reports, these sort of surveys, every now and then I'll see them from Christian communities too, on topics like abortion or gay marriage or these sorts of things.
Yes. Well, I think it's difficult to talk in general terms, really. We'd need to be looking at a particular report for me to make any comment But I mean, there are some surveys that are better than others. I think the World Value Survey is something of value. I think some Pew Research surveys are of value too. But I think we have to always, as the Muslim feminist scholar Fatima Minissi said, that we proceed best and live better where we seek doubt. And I think we should be doing that with a variety of statistics that we find flung out in the popular press for all kinds of things. And that is the problem, that you know, really getting closer to what is going on involves doing a lot of back work, you know, in terms of reading for yourself.
That's interesting. So seeking out doubt, it's almost as if the press were peddling uncertainty at a time when they really ought to be encouraging doubt.
Yes, I think the population perhaps need to, in a practical way, be a little clearer that the press is not there to educate them.
Mm. Yeah, that's quite true.
Because by default, we naturally seek education. And I'm not being patronizing to a public. I'm speaking to myself here.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we to get our education from? It's difficult about all kinds of things. I mean, we're having this conversation at the time in the middle of the whole Brexit debate and negotiations. Yeah. It's difficult for the journalists to, you know, get their stories straight.
Especially now. Yeah.
It is difficult for all of us to do that. But always to seek, you know, whatever we're talking about, it might be Extinction Rebellion, it might be Brexit, it might be whatever. We read something and we think, right, well, who might be giving a very different view about this? Where might I go to find that so that I can best engage in critical thinking? And am I, in effect, in an information silo or in some form of ghetto of opinions in terms of, you know, my place on social media, the friends I have? Am I, in this sense, subject to, you know, all forms of cognitive bias? And if I might be, what do I need to do to question that? I think these are good approaches that we all, myself included, need to take.
Yeah, it's essential for, as you say, good judgment to be able to form an opinion from as wide a variety of sources as possible. And speaking of judgment, you describe in the book two forms of judgment, the sort of common philosophical division between fact and value. But one thing I noticed was also a kind of dual character to the value judgments that you were making. On the one hand, the value of religion and religious practices as a kind of what can this bring to my life? And then on the other hand, a sort of courtroom judgment, like how bad is it or how good is it in the sort of criminal court kind of sense. And I was wondering if you had any thoughts about how these two forms of judgment interleave themselves into any discussion of religion or
yes.
How we can kind of think about them.
Yes, great. I'm very glad that you've raised this question because I think it's extremely important for the book. Early on in the first chapter, I mentioned the philosopher Martin Heidegger,
mm-hmm.
and his idea that we simply find ourselves in the world, that we simply, no one tells us what our life's about, we've just got to get on with it, and we find ourselves in a particular family and grow up and so forth. I want to emphasize in the book, really, that in terms of judgments about religion, we find ourselves at this point in time in the particular cultures and subcultures that we find ourselves within. In other words, it's not a barren, flat, featureless landscape in terms of the character of judgment. Religion has been judged, continues to be judged, and this is something that is changing all the time. So the book is written, it enters into a situation, and as such, for example, I do refer quite a bit to Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and other of the new atheists, as they're called, because they have made quite critical judgments of religion. They've caught the public eye, and it's reasonable that they are considered defenders of religion. You know, Keith Ward would be an example. You know, Alistair McGrath would be another example of people who have sought to defend Christianity, for example, in relation to this new atheism. And, you know, so we are inevitably, you know, left, if we are doing what I set out to do, which is to give an ethical evaluation of faiths at their practice today, we, at a variety of points, find ourselves to be saying, well, you know, how endemic is anti-Semitism in the body politic of Christianity?
Yeah.
You know, it's not an unreasonable question. How misogynistic is Islam? You know, they're not unreasonable questions. Just as I believe it's not unreasonable to question the very idea of a body politic or a DNA to religion, that, and I generally reject these things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I believe that Islam is very plural. Christianity is very plural. And this is why we must always pay attention to detail. So, yes, we are at times making harsh judgments, judgments about very serious issues. Religion is at times and at points on trial in this book,
mm-hmm.
as are the new atheists too. This
yeah,
is not
true.
A camera focused in any one direction. In fact, you know, in the as the book comes to a close, entitled in the last chapter "Beyond Conclusions," the camera is you know, open to the reader, where do they want to turn the lens and ask the questions. You know, it is in that sense open. You know, and I would say something else. I think this idea of a neutral judgment, I think the concept of neutrality is problematic. Whose neutrality? I'm not saying that we shouldn't try and be fair. I think we should. But my way of trying to do that has been by bringing in a range of diverse voices that have not had their say by the end of the book. The book continues in the lives of anyone who reads it, in their comments, in their views, and in their actions. And that, you know, if a book is about important questions in our lives and about the world, that's how things should be.
Yeah, it's interesting because contrasting Richard Dawkins' book with yours, yours has a significantly more descriptive character to it, and his has a more sort of prosecutorial character to it, I think. Mm. And that's why this division between this kind of this sort of evaluation in the sense of like I'm comparing products I want to purchase versus evaluation where I want to find a culprit for something bad. In the case of religion, Dawkins loves to make religion the culprit of misogyny, the source of all bigotry and these sorts of things.
Yes, I mean Richard Dawkins, I call him an evangelical atheist. He is trying to convert as many people as he can globally to his form of atheism. While I am an atheist, I have no desire to convert anyone to have the beliefs that I have. But there's another crucial difference between what Dawkins is trying to do and what I'm trying to do. He has decided in advance of writing his various books about religion, his most recent one, Outgrowing God, I've just been having a look at, and I don't see that his views and intentions have particularly changed from the time of him writing The God Delusion. He has what he takes to be a scientific and a moral and an intellectual agenda to get people to relinquish the burden and the moral deficit that is religion from their lives. I didn't set out in my book to have an agenda of either being pro-religion or against religion. On the contrary, the book was and remains for me an adventure of discovery. I'm interested in what I don't know, not in what I already know to propound. I want to be proven wrong about things that I've said. It's much more interesting than being right. It changes what you think.
Yeah.
And I think there is a, I'm really interested in the questions. And I think that Richard Dawkins thinks that he has found an answer that is right and he must propound it for everyone and sell it. And that is what he is doing. And I don't think that he's really taken the time that is needed to understand religion particularly well. He's too busy with that agenda to really slow down and do what needs to be done.
Yeah, it's interesting. It just occurred to me that that maybe the title of the book should have been Understanding Religion, because you do a great deal more understanding in this book, and he does a great deal more judging in the sort of
yes, but there's ambiguity in the title Judging Religion, in the sense that in a way I am seeking to judge the judgments of religion. I'm raising that as part of the dialogue for our time.
Yeah.
But I also want to make clear the urgency of the book, because we do need to make judgments all the time. Do I join the Humanists UK? Do I campaign for voluntary euthanasia to be legal? All of these things are things that religion impacts upon. where do I think lie the limits of free speech for religious people, for non-religious people? My views about religion really impact upon those questions. So all kinds of things that are important for our time, we actually have to make judgments about. So it's not enough to understand. We also have to act.
Yeah.
And that brings us to the issues of multiculturalism. Because that is something that we need to continue to act about, and there is much discussion going on, and different visions that are being put forward. For example, a writer who's also been, I think Ted Cantor was head of, I might have got this wrong, Leicester City Council, I think. So he's not simply an academic, but his ideas of interculturalism are, I think, things that are really quite important. That there needs to be a more public engagement that I think moves away from, again, yes, frankly, some of the racist views of some elements within some aspects of the press and some politicians and spokespeople, and we need to have a much more sensible discussion about this.
Interculturalism.
Yes.
What is that, and what's the difference between that and multiculturalism?
Well, my understanding is that I think the word multiculturalism has, been taken through the mud, and it has been stereotyped as being the idea that we have in, say, somewhere like Britain, potentially, we have a variety of subcultures that live alongside each other, but don't have too much to do with each other. That live peaceably, but with a fair amount of isolation from other elements within the society.
Self-segregated.
Linguistically, we might sort of think about this, and that it is the duty of public services to do everything to cater for the particularities, say linguistically, of all the subgroups within a society. And so we have a potential ghettoisation there. And now I think that is a stereotype that has developed about multiculturalism. And I think that as well, again, it's a half-truth. Mm-hmm. That this picture is a picture that to some degree here and there matches up to how some aspects of Britain have developed. I think at the opposite end of the spectrum we have an idea of assimilationism,
mm-hmm.
Where in effect we must not simply all, as British citizens, subscribe to a specific set of values, but that we shouldn't deviate culturally too far from a given norm. Interculturalism, my understanding of Ted Cantor, is somewhere in the middle between this, and he's used this phrase, interculturalism, because multiculturalism has become such a dirty word. I mention it because I'm in agreement with a kind of middle way. And for example, I think we across the board need to discourage homeschooling, whether it's people homeschooling their children for political reasons or religious reasons. It's important that children get to know more of the world than is there within their families and the friends that they might have by being in the families that they are in. And I think, too, that it's important that children do, to some extent, mix with children who come from different backgrounds to their own. I think that's really crucial. This means that having very segregated societies, whether self-imposed segregation or otherwise, is not good. And it's something that it's important where that is the case that I think Britain moves a bit away from that. Mm. Okay. I think that is important. I also think that it is important that all people in Britain do learn English as the national language to a limited extent. I do actually think that's important. I think that and I think we should do everything culturally to encourage that. But for example, I'm not in favour of closing all religious schools at all. I think we need provisos, though. I think that, so, and here's a reason. If we were to close, as the National Secular Society, Stephen Evans for Humanist UK is campaigning persistently about the segregation that religious schools bring about. And I would agree with him up to a point. Where we have religious schools that offer very limited access to people of other religions or no religion into them, then I think that's a real problem. I think that schools... My point is that if we were to close all religious schools, we would have a real spike in homeschooling, children would be even less protected. We have to be pragmatic. So being continuous with the culture that we have in Britain at present, we need to continue to have religious schools. But we have limits. We should be closing down schools, for example, whether they're Muslim, Jewish, or Christian, that teach against human evolution. We cannot have educational institutions, whether they're private or state-funded, we can't have educational institutions that teach against the facts of science. So I'm putting some very clear markers down. And I think that this is important. I'm pushing for a direction where we have a bit more integration in British society, more mixing, that moves against having specific ghettoized cultures, but at the same time is one to say, for example, that Buddhists, that Hindus, that Muslims are just as much members of British culture and a part of British culture as are Christians, atheists, members of the Church of England, or anything else. I think that's very, very important. What it is to be a citizen is not something in a democracy to impose on people, but to ask people what they think about. And Muslims, for example, are as much a part of that discussion as anyone else. There again, this is a dialogue for our time. Beyond conclusions, it is something that we need to engage with. And I would say, too, that in some cases we need to get beyond the gatekeepers of some minority communities.
Mm.
I think that that is another issue that I get this from, for example, some members of the Muslim community who have said exactly this to me as being, you know, part of a problem.
Some of the proposals you've offered here, doesn't it presuppose at least a minimal set of hierarchically higher values than might be present in all these disparate communities? For example, you mentioned a democratic society. Anyone coming into Britain would have to take on democracy as a value if they were to want to participate democratically.
To respond to that, I think the first thing that I would want to say is that if we look at, for example, surveys about democracy in the Middle East, the majority of people seem, across much of the Middle East, very much seek democracy. The idea that democracy is the preserve of the West or of Britain in terms of what people actually desire is false. It's exactly where democracy is something that is people are deprived of, essentially, where they cry out for it often most. So I think this picture of people coming into Britain, they need to be educated in terms of, well, you must sign up to democracy, because by default we imagine that you are not signed up to that, or you don't believe in it in some ways. That's something that we should more than question. That's invariably not the case. Also, there are, of course, people in Britain who don't necessarily believe in democracy. And the whole Brexit debate, for example, is a debate in part about some of that question, and also about the question of what democracy means. And about that question, what democracy means, in a democratic society, that itself is an open, ongoing debate. For example, do we want to keep Britain as a parliamentary democracy? I hope we do, personally. Do we want to have referendums about anything and everything? I hope not, and most countries that are democratic, for very good reasons, don't want to do that. So once someone becomes a British citizen, they are as much a part of the conversation about what democracy is as is anyone else. Now, I don't want to, for a minute, pretend that there are not ideologues, and some powerful ideologues, that reject democracy. There are. Within Islam, for example, there is one very significant 20th century scholar called Maududi, who clearly does not particularly believe in democracy. Ayatollah Khomeini, when he became the supreme leader of Iran, clearly, you know, while large swathes of the population very much supported him, he was not a democrat. And these do raise important questions that we do need to think about. I think, again, as far as Islam is concerned, that we need to, and this issue has come from members within Muslim communities that I've spoken to, we do need to get past some of the gatekeepers of communities at times that want to speak on behalf of the entire community that they purport to represent. I think that there are questions there. There are equally questions, though, about the wider society, where particular people say that they, you know, speak on behalf of vast swathes of the population. They may be on the far right. They may be, you know, variously situated. But in a democracy, we check this kind of thing out. All right. So, yes, democracy is important. Just what it involves is something that is an ongoing discussion across the very wide variety of what British society and British citizenry amounts to.
Underlying that, though, as well, is yet another political principle that we're expecting groups to take on board, which is essentially the protection of individual rights, or some at least limited sense of individualism as a political doctrine, because without that, where do you get the authority to step in when an individual is threatened by a community?
Yeah. Again, I you know, leave open various things. I mean, the issue of individualism will be something that is open to discussion, and law and democracy will be the context in which such values are worked out in an ongoing way. So I don't think that we have anything written in stone. That is the nature of human discourse and human life, which is why the pure imposition of things is not quite how it can ever be, because a community is part of the society, that is itself, and they are themselves enfranchised.
Right, there's a full relationship.
There is, but I come back to the issue of consistency. There is an inconsistency about a community saying to the state, we seek your protections. However, we have carte blanche to mistreat, if we so choose, individuals within our communities. The issue about rights is one that will be ongoing, quite rightly ongoing. And so, for example, the valorization of human rights by Western countries such as Britain doesn't make entire sense after the war in Iraq. Yeah. The accusation of hypocrisy is an understandable accusation that is brought. Which human rights for who, when do they start, when do they stop? All of these questions are legitimate. But I do think that, as I've said, we can achieve a better multicultural discourse in Britain. Yeah.
All right. Well, that concludes Exiting the Cave's very first interview. I hope you've all enjoyed it, and I hope to be doing more of these in the future. Before I end this podcast, I'd just like to put in a mention for the London School of Philosophy. It's a school meant to offer philosophy to just about anyone who's interested in it, and it's run by a number of excellent philosophers. If you want to hear more from John, this would be a good place to go. John is presently teaching a course there called Visions of a Better World, which started in October, so I think enrollment might be closed for that. But more courses will be coming up in coming terms, and you can learn more about that at www.londonschoolofphilosophy.org. And with that, I will see you all later.